This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, over the weekend, since the Taoiseach announced the restrictions would be relaxed, dramatically really relaxed on Friday night, there has been a sense of euphoria in the country, understandable really after the 2 years of the COVID pandemic, that people should feel relief at the removal of most of the restrictions. However, internationally and indeed even at home, there are still many people being infected by the Omicron variant of the COVID virus. And to look at where we are now, it's a pleasure to welcome to the stand Professor Paul Moynagh, Professor of Immunology at Maynooth University. Paul, people were really happy and there was euphoria, I think is the best description, at the prospect of the world that the Taoiseach laid out, which is really no vaccine passes required anymore. And the only restriction appears to be continued use of masks. How careful do we need to be at this stage?
So as you say, I mean, yeah, it was greeted with euphoria, probably with some surprise in terms of how suddenly it happened and the announcement that basically all restrictions were being lifted based on how cautious NPHET have tended to be over the last 2 years. That probably came somewhat as a surprise as well. But I think the fact that we've experienced such difficult circumstances over the last 2 years, there's a lot of relief and, as you say, euphoria with respect to that we're beginning to get back to some degree of normality. I think if you look at the virus itself, Eamon, a couple of things that really changed, Omicron variant especially, for a number of different reasons. First of all, it's so highly transmissible. I think it got to the stage where if you look by the time this peak wanes, you could be looking at situations where maybe half the population have been infected with the Omicron variant. Obviously, that number hasn't been confirmed in terms of detected infections, but it's accepted now. We're only picking up a fraction of those that are infected. So that's obviously, it's very worrying in terms of how transmissible that is. But I think one of the key factors was in terms of how that translated into hospitalizations, serious illness, and especially ICU.
Yes.
Certainly the rate of hospitalization, serious illness was very low compared with the rates of from previous waves. And that was due to two reasons. One was because the Omicron variant itself is milder. And, you know, there are a number of lab-based studies now giving an explanation or a plausible explanation for that, in the sense that the Omicron variant is very good at infecting cells in our upper respiratory system, but not so good at infecting cells in our lower respiratory system and in our lungs. And that's where really the virus causes the problem in terms of pneumonias and causing serious illness and hospitalization. But then the Omicron tends to infect people as well, because if they can create one part of our immune response that's mediated by antibodies, it tends to infect people who have been vaccinated or previously infected. And in those cases, the background immunity is standing up really well in terms of protecting against serious illness. So I think the key circumstances coming together was that here we have a variant that transmits really very, very efficiently, but yet is not translating into cases that would put the health system a significant risk. And I think that was one of the reasons why it was accepted that maybe we should begin to look at returning to some degree of normality. And I think as well, Eamon, if you were to look at the restrictions that were in place, it would be difficult to say that the restrictions were working in actually curtailing the spread of the variant. And I say that because I think Tony Holland the week before last mentioned that during that week, their estimates were that 500,000 people were infected in a given week by the virus. So if we were to look over the last 6 to 8 weeks, we would probably look at maybe half the population having been infected despite some of the restrictions still being in place. So I'm not sure how effective those restrictions were in terms of curtailing transmission of Omicron. It's just a really, really difficult variant to control in terms of its transmission. And I think it's because of that we've moved to a situation now where rather than focusing on transmission, we're focusing in terms of improving outcomes if infection does happen.
Yes, now a couple of quotes come to my mind immediately. One is from the Secretary of State for Health, Sajid Javid, in the UK, and the other is from our own Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly. He said, what we're experiencing, and I'm quoting Stephen Donnelly, what we're experiencing now with Omicron is more like flu, and we never used a vaccine pass for that. And that's precisely what Sajid Javid said in the UK. He said there are good reasons to open up for the economy and for people's mental health for all kinds of reasons that are obvious. However, let me ask you about the comparisons with the flu and in the wilder shores of the UK with the common cold. With the flu, there's no long flu, is there? And there is long COVID. That's one question. And, you know, of course, the same applies to the common cold, which is also, in both cases, a virus. The dispensing with the vaccine pass for hospitality indoors, restaurants, bars, and does that mean if I go and I have a compromised immune system, if I go to a bar or a restaurant, I could be sitting next to somebody who hadn't been vaccinated at all, who hadn't been fully vaccinated and received a booster. Where's the sense in that? Because before the announcement on Friday by Micheál Martin, it had been speculated that the vaccine passes would be retained until the end of March.
Yeah, so first of all, in terms of comparing the SARS coronavirus 2 with the flu and common cold coronaviruses, certainly because we've only known about this virus for a couple of years, it's difficult to assess in terms of the long-term health impacts of the virus. Certainly we know in situations, and in some cases, people for a long number of months post-infection, yes, to do exhibit symptoms associated with which we now refer to as long COVID. In terms of the studies around that, again, it's difficult to get precise numbers on that. And some of the studies would suggest that, some have suggested that, for example, even people who are not seropositive in the sense that they have been infected, and some have described symptoms similar to what has been associated with long COVID. So yes, I think there is no doubt that there are cases, absolutely. And in other viruses as well, we do see symptoms and syndromes the long time post-viral clearance.
Yes.
But in terms of, we're at a different stage here, and I guess only time will tell in terms of the long-term consequences associated with COVID infection. But certainly with respect to the Omicron, it certainly is milder than the previous variants for two reasons, Eamon, as I said. One is in terms of that's inherently less severe in terms of the disease it causes, but also because it's against the background of a high degree of immunity. Yes. That immunity that has been generated mostly by vaccination, but also by prior infection now. In terms of moving on to vaccine passes, so I think it really depends in terms of what you want to use the vaccine pass for. One of the things that we have to accept is that vaccines were designed to protect against serious illness, and they've done a fantastic job in that sense. And I think you've seen that now with the very high levels of transmission we've seen. The vaccines have given us this wall of protection that has protected us really, really well. I think one of the mistakes that we made was describing people who've been vaccinated subsequently getting infected, these as breakthrough infections, suggesting that the vaccines have failed. Vaccines were not designed to protect against infection. And we now know that even post-vaccination, post-infection, it is possible to get infected. The vaccines do give us some protection, and some protection for a short time period. And the vaccines and the boosters, what they will do is boost the production of antibodies. Antibodies stops us from getting infected. But those antibodies, they can wane after a number of months, and that's why we become prone to infection. But importantly, the vaccines still protect us really well against serious illness. So in terms of going into environments where vaccine passes exist, yes, vaccines do protect us against infection, probably for a short period of time. They probably do blunt and temper and reduce onward transmission, because even if you're infected, the immunity that you have from vaccine and from boosting, that will tend to clear the virus more quickly. So there's a reduced chance of passing it on. But it doesn't get to zero. So because somebody has been vaccinated, it doesn't mean it's not possible that they will get infected and pass it on. Probably where vaccine passes have worked well, especially probably in younger people, is in terms of it's encouraged more people to get vaccinated. But yes. My own personal view, Eamon, is that in terms of vaccine mandate, just my personal opinion is that I wouldn't be a supporter of vaccine mandates, in the sense that I think the country is, and it's been an incredible success in terms of the vaccination program. You know, we've over 90% of the eligible population fully vaccinated, over 2.5 million, close to 3 million people boosted. There's been incredible uptake and solidarity here with respect to the vaccination program. And I think that has worked really well in terms of explaining how vaccines work, how effective they have been. And I think that's the way to go and work with people and get the trust of people, and that they trust in terms of the public health advice that we're getting. As we look now in terms of where the vaccine passports exist, there seems to be an inconsistency in terms of where they are being used. And my only interpretation can be is that they continue to be used in those environments where people don't have a choice, in terms of, for example, in retail and going to shop, whereas going into restaurants, people have a choice in terms of whether to go in there or not. So right. In terms of vaccine passports, should they be used or not, they probably will help in terms of encouraging people to continue to get vaccinated, to continue to get boosted. But our starting point there, Eamon, is a really high level of people having bought into that, having got the vaccines, having got the boosters. And it's for that reason that we've ended up where, despite the really high levels, the very high levels that we've encountered over the last number of weeks, again, our health system has not been put under threat. And it's mostly, I think, because of the vaccines and the protective effects in terms of protecting us against serious illness.
Yes, and I mean, the protection of the health service and the workers in the health service, and of course, people who are on waiting lists for other conditions, has been a huge factor in our fight against this vaccine. The other factor, of course, is the economy and economic consequences for people who might lose their livelihoods, their jobs, their businesses, and all of that. Can I ask you about the international situation? Because we are part of a larger world, and in Europe, I noticed in Belgium yesterday, I think something like 500,000 infections. In France, 400,000, I think, on Friday. And it's extremely serious in Europe. How dangerous is that in terms of new variants? And how can we as a society here protect ourselves and understand at least where we are along the journey of, as it were, coming to terms with COVID?
I think the one thing the Omicron variant has taught us, Eamon, is that it's very extremely difficult to control its transmission. I think it is so transmissible that despite having restrictions in place and trying to put public health measures in place to try to reduce its transmission, I think almost the last number of weeks have shown us in Ireland that we've almost been powerless against it. Because if you look at the figures, the number of confirmed cases, and accepting that they're an underestimate of the actual number of cases, we're probably looking at a situation where half the population have been infected with the Omicron variant, if not already, certainly over the coming weeks. And that's with some restrictions already having been in place. And I think that's what we're seeing in other countries as well. And it can be at different times. It's difficult to compare countries at just with a, at a specific time, point in time. But I think it's over and over. And different countries are showing that the Omicron variant is extremely difficult to control.
Right. Let me ask you about the difference. There's a couple of questions relating to Delta and Omicron. When you say Omicron is incredibly transmissible, I've seen it said that as transmissible as measles, which was very. So with Delta, it was said 2 meters apart to keep your space away from other people, masked properly, and that will keep you safe, or should keep you safe from Delta. What makes Omicron different and more transmissible and more dangerous? Are there more ways of getting it? Does it hang around in the air? I know it's an aerosol effect. Are 2 meters, for example, are the normal protection masks and even medical grade masks plus social distancing, are they, even they, insufficient in certain circumstances against Omicron?
I think one of the main reasons why it's so transmissible, Eamon, especially against the background of high vaccination rates, is that it can evade some of our immunity. So when we get the virus, when we get SARS coronavirus 2, we generate two types of immunity. We make antibodies to protect us against infection, but we also make T cells so that if we are infected, the T cells can go in and kill any virally infected cells.
Right.
The Omicron, the spike protein in the surface of the Omicron, has a number of mutations, like 32 mutations, so that those regions of the spike protein that our antibodies normally recognize, those regions have been changed now in Omicron, so that our antibodies don't work as well. We can partially get around this by boosting, because that increases the repertoire and diversity of antibodies that we produce. But again, it doesn't get us back to that same level of protection against protection against infection. So that's one of the main things, Eamon, in terms of it's bypassing some of the protective effects of our immunity. And, you know, you'll have encountered many cases of people who've been doubly vaccinated and indeed boosted and yet still end up getting infected by Omicron. I think the second reason, then, Eamon, is because it is very good at infecting cells in our upper respiratory system and can replicate to very high levels there. And that probably helps in terms of onward transmission as well.
Right.
But certainly I think in terms of its evasive properties, not so much with respect to the protective effects that vaccines offer us in terms of protecting against serious illness, but in terms of protecting against initial infection, this variant has been very good in terms of evading those early defense systems which are offered by our antibodies.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, now, the waning immunity issue. I saw some American studies produced by Sanjay Gupta, who's an immunologist at CNN News, and he's been extremely interesting and understandable and very good. He talked about the waning immunity of vaccines, in some cases waning to maybe 47% immunity, in others up to the high 80s. And he was talking over a time frame of maybe 6 months before immunity begins to wane quite seriously. I'm asking this in the context of people who are, as you said here, Paul, very high compliance, over 90% of people with the boosters and everything. What do they need to be mindful of now in terms of the waning of their immunity?
So first of all, I'd say, Eamon, they've done a really good thing in terms of Ireland, the Irish community and society have done a really good thing in terms of the level of vaccination, both in terms of the double doses, but also in terms of being boosted. If you look at other countries where, for example, death rates are higher than death rate here in Ireland, for example, if you look at the US, death rates are higher there. And one of the reasons there is the lower vaccination rate. So first of all, it's a really good thing that, you know, in terms of the vaccination rates that we have. With respect to waning immunity, really important here, Eamon, to distinguish between the two types of immunity that we generate. The first one, as I've already alluded to, the ones that when we're infected by the virus or vaccinated, we make antibodies. Antibodies stops our cells from being infected by the virus. But we also make T cells so that if you are infected, the T cells will go in there and eliminate the virus. With respect to waning immunity, when we make the antibodies, either from the vaccine or a booster, those antibodies will increase, and they will increase and stay at elevated levels probably for a short number of months, maybe between 3 and 6 months. But then those antibodies wane off, and they have to, Eamon, because we're exposed to so many different other viruses, bacteria that we make antibodies against, that if the antibodies didn't begin to temper off in our bloodstream would just be full of antibodies, and that just wouldn't be, the blood couldn't do what it normally does. So as a result, after those number of months, we do become susceptible to infection again. But importantly, this second arm of immunity, the T-cell immunity, that if you are infected, they will go in and they will clear the virus before it gets a chance to gain a foothold in the body. And the reason why this prevents us from getting ill is because the virus, which is in the upper respiratory system, these T-cells are eliminating it before it gets a chance to go into a lower respiratory system and into the lungs where it causes the illness. The good thing about the T-cells, Eamon, is that their longevity is much longer than, for example, with antibodies.
Yes.
Back, if you look at the initial SARS outbreak back in 2003, there's some studies showing there that those T-cells that were activated at that stage are still active and still there and can still be re-triggered, you know, 15, 17 years later.
Right.
So that immunity is longer lasting. So, and the other thing, Eamon, that I should specify here is that if you look at how antibodies work, antibodies, when we're vaccinated, there are a small number of regions on the spike protein that the antibodies will recognize, maybe 5 or 6 different regions. And they're the regions that have been mutated in the Omicron. But if you look at the number of regions that the T cells recognize in the spike protein, there's up to 100 different regions that the T cells can recognize. In my view, Eamon, it would be very difficult for a variant to emerge that changes all of those regions to make the T cells completely ineffective, because if they changed all of those regions, you would end up with a spike protein where the virus wouldn't be able to infect our cells. So I'd be hopeful, and we haven't seen any variant that can totally escape our immunity. Yes, can escape the antibodies, and that's why we continue to see reinfections and some infections post-vaccination. But importantly, and we're seeing this throughout, we still have this situation where the vaccines are doing a fantastic good job in terms of protecting us against serious illness. And I would only get concerned, Eamon, if you begin to see breakthrough disease or breakthrough illness. So what I mean by that is people who have been prior infected or vaccinated, and then you begin to see high proportions of those people beginning to get very seriously ill with a new infection or with an infection post-vaccination. And we're not seeing that. Unfortunately, we do see it in small numbers, Eamon, as we do with other viruses, unfortunately. And that, I think, that will continue to be a feature of this. So we do need, obviously, to be mindful of immunocompromised individuals and those that, you know, their immune system hasn't triggered a protective response in response to the vaccine. But by and large, the vaccines are still doing a really good job in terms of protecting us against serious illness.
Now, the idea that's out there too, and has been talked about by many experts, is that Omicron will dispatch Delta, which was much more severe in its consequences, and that that can lead, And this is the rationale, I suppose, for people in the UK, for example, who are opening up gung-ho, you might say, even dispensing with masks, that if Delta, which was a much more severe and dangerous variant, that Omicron might get rid of it. And this may be the way, they say, that the virus will be rendered impotent and will be reduced to the level of flu, and you can have a vaccination every 6 months or whatever. Is that theory, in your view, respectable?
Yeah, so the first thing to say there is just spend a little bit of time in terms of saying how these variants arise and why they become dominant. And again, that's a completely random process. So when you were to look at the Delta variant, as the Delta variant replicates, like all the other variants, as they replicate, the genetic material that is the code that makes all of the viral proteins, that is usually replicated in a perfect manner. So you get an exact copy and the variant continues to be as is. But every now and again, there's a mistake made in the replication and you end up with what's called a mutation. Most of those mutations are damaging to the virus. And you never see those variants because they end up not being able to infect the cells. They're not propagated. They don't replicate. Every now and again, you have mutations that gives the virus a selective advantage. And that's what happened with Omicron. It ended up with mutations that made it better. It was more transmissible. And then that's why it becomes the dominant variant. We know that people who've been infected with Omicron, yes, it gives you really good protection against Delta. But the reason why the Omicron has become the most dominant variant now is because it transmits so well. So it, yes, it competes out with the Delta variant. But going forward, is this the end? That will continue to happen, Eamon. The Omicron will continue to mutate. That's just the nature of biology. As these viruses and as these variants replicate, mutations happen. These are completely random. What probably the more pertinent question, Eamon, is, you know, is it possible to get a variant that is more virulent? And what I mean by that is a variant that can cause more severe disease.
Yes.
It'd be difficult, you know, to get one that is more transmissible because it's so highly transmissible, but could you end up with a variant that causes more severe disease? Or some people think over time, does it just automatically mean that viruses end up being less virulent over time? And again, that's a completely random process. From the point of view of the existence and the success of the virus, it doesn't really matter. Once a virus can get in, infect somebody, infect our cells, replicate, and then is transmitted onwards to other people, it doesn't really matter for the success of the virus whether that person in a number of weeks time dies or not. The worst thing a virus could do would be to get in, infect somebody, and immediately kill somebody.
Yes.
Because what happens then is the virus can't be propagated and the virus would die out with that person. So whether it causes more disease or not, again, that's a random process. We've seen with Omicron, it's mutated so much that it's very good at transmitting, it's very good at evading our antibodies, but with all of those mutations, it's ended up that it's less well adapted
yes.
to infect cells in the lower respiratory system. But again, that was just a random process, and these are just random processes, and the virus will continue, like other viruses, will continue to mutate. But importantly, Eamon, as it mutates, it's not like going back to March 2020. March 2020, we were looking at a virus where we'd never seen this before. So we would describe that as we were immunologically naive.
Yes.
We've never seen this before. Most of us now, for example, in countries like Ireland, most of us have either seen this virus before or we've seen part of the virus through the spike protein that we've got with the vaccine. So we are not starting from scratch here. So it, even though there are mutations happening, we've still seen most of this virus or most of the spike protein. And we have changes that, yes, can make it get around our antibodies, but I still think it's going to be difficult for a variant to arise and change so much that it gets around and evade our T-cell immunity. And it's that T-cell immunity that tends to protect us from serious illness. So obviously we need to be vigilant and going forward in terms of, you know, if there's new variants and just characterizing them, not only in terms of the transmissibility, but also in terms of their virulence and the potential to induce disease. But again, the fact that we have this background wall of immunity, I think that's going to benefit us enormously.
Okay, just a final double question, Paul, because that has been really interesting. In the world, the United States is a classic example of really a cavalier approach, and indeed the whole thing of vaccines has been politicized greatly, profoundly, really. And therefore, there are so many sick people, so many infected people, that that's the world we're living in. We can see in Europe even the vast amounts of virus that is out there. How concerning is that? And just the second part of the question in brackets, the experience of the Spanish flu pandemic, as it's known, from 1918, and that period, has that been a useful reference point for immunologists like yourself, and how that eventually died out?
Yeah, I think if you look at generally, pandemics come and go, Eamon, and the reason why they come and go is because of immunity. So initially, when you're exposed to something for the first time, like a virus, bacteria that you've never seen before, it takes some time to generate that immunity, to clear it, and during that time, it has a chance to gain a foothold in the body and cause serious illness. Once we've been exposed to it, unfortunately, in the absence of a vaccine, you have to go through that really high attrition in terms of that you get immunity by prior infection. Thankfully, in the case, and the savior for us really here has been the early development, and I say early because it's unprecedented in terms of how quickly the vaccines were produced, but that has saved so many lives here. And we can see that. We can see that now. We've now got to this stage, and again, some people may be considered in terms of how fast we've moved here with respect to moving restrictions, but the reasons is because of our high vaccination rates, and it's that protection that the vaccines are giving us. And I think, again, if you look across globally, this is a global problem. So while we may be in, you know, in a good place here at the moment in terms of our levels of protection, we do need to look at this as a global problem.
Yes.
There are many countries where the vaccination rates are very low, and that in some cases due to vaccine hesitancy, but also due in terms of poor availability of the vaccine. So I think really now there needs to be a global focus in terms of making sure that everybody is at least offered vaccination in the shortest possible time period on a global scale.
And just on the question of masks, Paul, the importance of masks, which I note have been retained on public transport and elsewhere in certain other settings, they remain essential, and the quality of them as well.
Yeah, I think the quality is that is the pertinent issue here, Eamon. And so if you look at all the data in terms of how effective masks are, again, it's most of that is based on observational data. If you look at randomized controlled trials, certainly what's coming out there is that the quality of the mask is really important. The FFP2 masks and higher, they're effective in terms of protecting against infection. But if you look at cloth masks, it's very difficult to get direct evidence in terms of their protective effects. So going forward, I think that should be a focus. I think the messaging there should be clear in terms of the quality of mask that is used, and especially around the use of FFP2s. Because I think what has been shown over the last number of months, because this is transmitted so well, despite all our restrictions, and I think despite really high compliance and adherence to mask wearing over the last number of months, we've still ended up with enormous numbers of infections. And again, if we were to focus on mask and the adherence to mask wearing, I think good messaging around in terms of the quality of mask, I think that would certainly be worthwhile.
Okay, Professor Paul Moynihan, Professor of Immunology at Maynooth University, thank you very much for joining us on The Stand. That's all we have time for now. We're grateful to Professor Moyna, to all of you for listening. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.